Key economic releases affecting fixed income yields. Insights into sectors influencing fixed income securities. How AAM plans to capitalize on these themes for your fixed income portfolio. The Portfolio Fix is a podcast series featuring members of AAM's investment and portfolio management team. We will discuss the timely issues affecting the fixed income investments of our insurance clients.
Welcome to another episode of The Portfolio Fix, a podcast series from AAM. My name is Patrick McGeever. Today we'll be speaking with Gene Preddy, the CIO of Zasoff Associates, and Tim Seneschal, a portfolio manager with AAM, who works closely with the team at Zasoff. Before we get to Gene and Tim, though, we wanted to speak with Marco Bravo to get his take on yesterday's GDP print. So welcome, Marco.
Thanks, Pat.
Annualized GDP in the first quarter was negative 5%, and in the second quarter was negative 31%. So we got our first look at the third quarter number. So I guess our question is, what was it? What were the key takeaways, and were there any surprises?
Sure. Well, U.S. gross domestic product for the third quarter increased by 7.4% or 33.1% on an annualized basis. And it's worth noting that this is an initial estimate and will be subject to two additional revisions as more data comes in. But the growth rate in the third quarter was unprecedented. And as you correctly noted, Pat, you know, it follows a record 31.4% annualized decline in the second quarter. And the overall level of gross domestic product is still about 3.5% below where it ended in 2019. It really shouldn't be that surprising that economic activity here in the U.S. has bounced back the way it has, given how strong the U.S. economy was just prior to the government shutdowns, which were imposed to try and contain the spread of COVID-19. Having said that, though, the strength in Q3 was much better than economists' consensus forecasts, which were projecting an annualized growth rate for the quarter of 21% as recently as 2 months ago. And the strength of the consumer really surprised to the upside as personal consumption increased almost 41% on an annualized basis for the quarter. And that contributed over 25 percentage points to the overall growth rate. So a very significant contribution from the U.S. consumer. It's interesting that most of the increase in consumption was driven by spending on durable goods, as spending on services was more muted, as one would expect, given the continued social distancing restrictions. And as we've talked about in the past on this podcast, the housing market has come back strongly, and that strength showed up in the GDP report as well, as residential investment increased by 59% for the quarter on an annualized basis. Now, not all areas of the economy were strong. There were parts of the economy that remained weak, and those were business investment on structures, net trade as imports exceeded exports, and government spending at both the federal and state and local level. And we would expect government spending to remain weak until an additional fiscal aid package is passed out of Washington.
Okay, so given that information, what is AAM's expectation for GDP in the fourth quarter 2021? And you mentioned the fiscal aid package. Maybe you can state whether our expectations include or exclude any further stimulus.
Sure. Let me start by just giving you the consensus outlook today. So estimates among the economists are currently projecting an increase of 3.9% for GDP in the fourth quarter. Again, that's annualized, and 3.6% for all of 2021. So let's call it roughly around 4%. in the current quarter and into 2021. And again, we think the consumer will be the main driver of growth. And the consumer is starting the fourth quarter on a relatively strong note. Consumer confidence is up, albeit not back to pre-COVID levels. Personal spending continues to rise, as we saw from today's data release, which showed that spending was up 1.4% in September. And personal incomes rose more than expected last month. The personal savings rate ended the quarter at just over 14%, and that should be supportive for spending in the months ahead. Also, the number of people filing for unemployment claims continues to come down, which is another positive. So the consumer is starting the fourth quarter on a strong note, and we think that will continue into 2021. Away from the consumer, we think that strength in the housing market will continue given the low mortgage rates and increased demand for suburban homes. So residential investment should continue to be a positive contributor to overall GDP growth. Now, for sure, there's downside risks out there. We've started to see an increase in COVID-19 cases, and if that continues, one would expect it could lead to government-imposed shutdowns, as well as the labor market. A slower-than-expected recovery in the labor market is another risk, as we have seen a slowing in the monthly job growth. And the unemployment rate, which currently stands at 7.9%, is expected to average 6.2% in the fourth quarter of 2021. So a very modest decline from current levels. And to bring up your question regarding a fiscal aid package, the expected slow decline in the unemployment rate kind of reinforces the importance of additional fiscal policy out of Washington. At AAM, we still think the odds are good that we see some agreement before the end of this year, although a delay definitely could put pressure on consumer spending, especially if the labor market recovery stalls, as well as put pressure on spending at the state and local government level. Looking at holistically, we view the strengths and the risks to GDP growth as balanced, and therefore we would expect the growth rate to come in as projected, again around 4% for the current quarter and just under 4% for 2021.
Okay, there's a lot to digest there, but I think my key takeaway is we're expecting 4% or somewhere around 4% growth in 2021. What does that mean for our expectation of treasury rates and any changes in the curve?
Well, let's start with Fed policy. We don't see any change in Fed policy for the foreseeable future, mainly due to the fact that inflation continues to be relatively benign, and with the unemployment rate not expected to fall significantly, we think the Fed remains on hold through the end of 2021. So that means short-term rates, short-term treasury yields, which are pegged to Fed funds, will remain low. As we move out the yield curve, the 10-year and 30-year, if we do see growth rate in the GDP at around a 4% level, we think that does put pressure on longer-term rates to move higher. And so we would expect longer term rates to move modestly higher from the current level. The expectation among economists is for 10-year yields to end 2020 run around a 1.1% level. So modest increase from current levels and a steeper yield curve is the forecast for next year regarding treasury yields.
Okay, that's really helpful, Marco. A lot of really unknown moving pieces here, and the way you frame it makes it much easier to understand. So thanks a lot for that. Next time we speak, it will thankfully be post-election, so hopefully we get some clarity on stimulus and how that might influence a number of items, including employment, consumer spending, and GDP. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we're joined by Gene Preti, the CIO of Zasoff Associates, and my colleague Tim Seneschal, who is a portfolio manager with AAM. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Pat.
As a quick reminder, Zasoff Associates is our partner for convertible securities management. And for those of you who might not be that familiar with convertible bonds, it is a hybrid of corporate debt and equity, which, when managed as Zasoff does, offers both return upside tied to the equity market and substantially less risk. So, Gene, speaking of risk, when we last spoke to you in early September, you stated that you had positioned your portfolios for potential volatility. Well, we've gotten that volatility, as you predicted. Since that time, the VIX, or the volatility index, has risen by about 50%. And the stock market has declined by more than 5% in the past 2 weeks. So with that, how has your strategy held up during this time?
In general, it's held up very well. So we always position our portfolio to be protected on the downside should we see these kind of declines. And in September in particular, you did see a fairly quick downdraft in the market. I believe the NASDAQ fell something like 12%, and the S&P was roughly 10%. And we held up really nicely in that downdraft. And then toward the end of the month, you saw a little rally back. So we participated back in that. So good protection on the downside. And then in the last week or so, we've obviously seen some pretty significant volatility in the market as a whole, largely related to COVID, I guess, but also enormous single stock volatility with regard to earnings announcements, particularly in some of the growth names. So given the amount of issuance and the number of issues that are available, it's relatively easy for us to keep our portfolio position very attractively where we've got that protection on the downside, but we can participate on the upside as equities trend higher.
Okay. Hey, Gene, you mentioned the NASDAQ and the sell-off in September, and large cap tech shares have been really the big story in stock markets this year. Certainly been a huge influence on returns in the convert market as well. Is this sector the source of significant volatility broadly in your market in recent sessions?
Yeah, it has been a lot of the volatility as these kind of growth tech names have whipped around. Now, you know, within the convert market, it's very heavily weighted, particularly to software names, which have done extraordinarily well this year. And you've seen many of those names fall on the order of 20% in recent weeks. With regard to how the convertibles do, it does come down to structure, that a lot of those names that are trading way up the curve, you know, 3, 4, or 5 times par, they obviously participate 100% on the downside as those equities fall, whereas some of those names do have bond structures that are kind of in the middle of the curve. And those have actually performed very well. They protected on the downside. And our job in the portfolio is obviously to keep position in that middle part. So to the degree that we have exposure to those, that we have that downside protection that we're looking for.
You mentioned software and services, and we've talked a little bit in prior podcasts about technology exposure. Given the weighting of that sector in the index, given the proportion of issuance that's coming out of that sector, how do you manage industry exposure, maintaining kind of an acceptable level of correlation across your holdings in this market?
That's a great question. That you know, as technology has kind of evolved as an industry, there's obviously enormous numbers of subgroups within that, and trying to slice and dice those to kind of control exposures, if you will, is the goal. And, you know, a classic example of that would be Tesla, which is an auto manufacturer, is largely viewed as a technology company. So what we do within software, which is probably the biggest issue because it's roughly 25% of the market, there, number one, you're right, we're looking for correlation. And one of the things we can do is when we look at those entities to say, what is the source of their revenues or what is the basis of their business? So if it's an enterprise software where their revenues come from other companies, that's decidedly different than, say, a Priceline, where, albeit software, their revenues come from consumers or from selling airline tickets, which is a very different animal. So moving within that to kind of optimize those exposures, or I should say minimize those exposures, so that, again, correlation being the big constraint. And, you know, and this is a year where those names have done extraordinarily well, so limiting your risk there is a little bit of a headwind, but long run that pays off very well.
Gene, earlier you mentioned issuance, and I know back in September issuance was around $80 billion, and I think now we're getting close to $100 billion. That's almost double the amount of any year in the previous decade. So is your market suffering from any type of indigestion at this point?
Not really. There have been a couple of moments where, when there was a flood of issuance, where you started to see valuations come in a little bit, just from a supply-demand imbalance. But, you know, it was very muted in general. And issuance has quieted down for the last 3 weeks as we've gotten into earnings period. So the market's been able to digest that pretty well. In talking to the bankers, the expectations are that as we get into November, there probably will be another flurry of issuance as we get out of the quiet period for earnings season, and folks try to get things done before you get into year end, where the markets become more quiet. So far the market's digested it extremely well, and in fact probably better than we would have expected.
Gene, would you generalize valuations at all on new deal flow? Cheap, fair, or is there enough variety between technology and other industry issuance that it's hard to generalize?
I think if one were to generalize, I'd make the observation that in the second quarter, virtually all of the issuance that came was very attractively priced. As you evolved into the third quarter, you did see a little bit of a bifurcation where, and simplistically, if you kind of break the issuance into two groups, where you had some of what I would call opportunistic issuance, and that would be some of these technology and software names where stock prices were had run up exponentially. In those cases, a lot of the issues were slightly cheap, but not egregiously so. I would contrast that with the other bucket of issuance, which I would call strategic. And generally speaking, what we're talking about there are folks raising capital to help them manage COVID or get through the business cycle here. In most of those type of issues, they're still priced extraordinarily cheap. The one subtlety I'll point out is in all of these names, you're in a convertible, you're buying long-dated volatility. And generally speaking, when one values these, you put a cap on that volatility. So in many cases, we're buying vol that would be capped at 35 or 40. And if you look at the near-term and medium-term volatility in the options market, many of those names would have volatilities that would be in the 50s, 60s, 70s. So from that standpoint, it's an additional source of cheapness to the degree that volatility stays high, to Pat's earlier point.
Has that led to increased interest from the hedge fund community and convert ARB funds, Gene, in new issue markets?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest source of demand for the increased supply that we've seen is the increase in the hedge fund. That, again, with these structures, generally speaking, the credit quality is pretty good. The valuations are relatively attractive. The issue would be, in many cases, these stock prices are at very high levels and there's a lot of volatility. So that plays very well into a hedge fund strategy hand.
And so kind of flipping the coin on that, would, you know, if the business cycle stabilizes going into 2021, would reduced volatility be a headwind for valuations in the sector? Is that something that's on your radar as a potential headwind for converts?
certainly something that we monitor, although declining volatility, generally speaking, isn't something that you're going to feel in a long portfolio. You'll see things cheapen a little bit. Generally speaking, if that were to happen, the most likely outcome would be that you'd see a rise in the stock market. So that stock sensitivity to the upside would dwarf any kind of cheapening from volatility coming down.
In that environment, Gene, if we do see an expansion in the economy continue, albeit at a much slower pace than we've seen in the third quarter this year, next year, if the yield curve steepens, as AAM thinks it may, what dynamics do you think play out in the equity market? How do you think that affects particular industries or subcategories of the convert market or your strategy?
The easy answer would be one of the big laggards this year has been financials. And to the degree that you're at a steepening in the yield curve, that certainly would be conducive to those performing better. But maybe more importantly, if we are to get sustainable GDP growth, beyond the snapback that we've kind of witnessed so far, my suspicion is you'd see a much broader rally in the equity markets. And this kind of bifurcation that we've had so far this year, where anything that's kind of big cap growth or a beneficiary of working at home, et cetera, you'd see much better performance in the broader market, some of the more cyclical names and the COVID impacted names. And to the degree that the broader market does a little bit better, we're obviously more susceptible to that. That would be a really nice tailwind.
Insurance companies tend to have, call it, three quarters or more of their assets in investment grade fixed income. And given where yields are, where credit spreads are, the absolute returns in our markets look pale. Just curious how you think about prospects for absolute performance, for relative performance in the next couple of years, and what your models show for how your strategy will perform should stocks rally, should stocks sell off, et cetera. Just give us a flavor for how you view the opportunity set, your ability to deliver what you have through previous cycles.
Well, I think the big observation is kind of what you were touching on there. When you look at core fixed income, the combination of extraordinarily low treasury yields and then very tight spreads mean the absolute return there is obviously very low. And then, frankly, the risk is very high. If you think about it in terms of how many years of coupons can you lose for a small rise in rates, the risk reward isn't very compelling there now. In the convertible market, the combination of cheap valuations, all the issuance that we've seen, and frankly, the implied yields are still very attractive. It bodes very well for relative performance, particularly to fixed income. I guess the other concern folks tend to have out there is ultimately is the other side of all the stimulus that we're seeing now, both fiscal and monetary. Does that create inflation pressures in the future? Obviously, equities tend to be a good inflation hedge long run, and convertibles are a great way to get that exposure in a risk controlled way, but particularly when in a balanced fashion. So I think from a relative standpoint, things look very well, and in an absolute sense, again, given the correction that you've seen in most of the stock market, you'd certainly have the tailwind from equity prices going forward.
Gene, one last question from me. You're from Wisconsin, which we know is a key state as we turn the calendar to November. Curious about your prediction for the prospects for a navy blue and orange sweep rolling through Lambeau Field on November 29th.
I'll take the under.
Very good.
That's great. All right, Gene, that's great information. Thanks a lot for that. And thanks for taking the time to explain your views on the convertible market today. If the listeners have any questions about what we discussed today, please reach out to your portfolio manager or contact our marketing team at aamcompany.com. During our next podcast, Marco will review key economic developments, and we will be joined by another member of our investment team. Thanks.